being. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of hearing the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of hearing the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I don't know who's that. What was?
What's all the chatter?
There's some chatter there. I'm not quite sure who.
Go ahead.
Oh, there's Rick with. Oh, sorry, with his hospital attire. Sorry, Rick. You have to be in the hospital. But I hope they figure out what you got going on with you. So anyway, we might as well just get right to the subject matter here. We're starting chapter 5. And if you'll remember, we had chapters 1 through 4 were dealing with the various misconceptions. This one way of remembering chapter 1 through 4, I can't remember where it was, but it's that where the syllogism, it was right at the end, I think, of chapter 4. Where did it? Well, anyway, I found it very convenient to commit that to memory so that then you can bear in mind what the first four chapters were about and have some way of thinking about them. It was a syllogism that brought together all four erroneous, what we call them, the four erroneous conceptions or four misconceptions. And it goes, whatever is a product is impermanent, is impermanent because of being momentary. Whatever is impermanent is impure because it produces aversion. Whatever is impure is suffering because it harms. And whatever is suffering is selfless because it's not under its own power. So those...
Can you say it again, Josh?
What's that?
Say it again slowly.
Diane is saying, say it again slowly.
Ask him.
So I'll say it again slowly. Whatever is a product is impermanent because of being momentary. Momentary means it's changing one moment after the next. Whatever is impermanent is impure because it produces aversion. Whatever is impure is suffering because it harms. And whatever is suffering is selfless because it's not under its own power.
Page 113.
It's on 113, you found it?
113.
Yeah, thanks, Fred. Yeah, so if you look on page 113, then you can see that. Oh, it was a ways back, wasn't it? Yeah, there it is. Instead of impure, they put unclean here, but whatever. So, chapter 5 is quite a change, actually, from the four misconceptions, because we're now going to be talking about the bodhisattva deeds, and and it will resemble what Natalie and Diana have been going over in the engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds, or the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So in order to make the transition, I was thinking that it would be good if we looked at what the translator had to say about this chapter, and the translator being Ruth Sunam, and she gives a summary of each chapter in her introduction, and the introduction covers this particular chapter on pages 35 and 36. Well, just basically 35. So now we're talking about becoming a Buddha. So she starts with, if becoming a Buddha allows us to help living beings in the most effective ways, what is a Buddha like? So the fifth chapter describes a Buddha's compassionate and powerful activity, whose wellspring is perfect knowledge. So we have to remember, when she's using the word perfect knowledge here, it means a Buddha is somebody who's eliminated all faults or all flaws or all defects and it achieved all good qualities. So a Buddha is a perfect being. So then perfect knowledge, we have to use the word perfect knowledge. Then every action is an expression of compassion. An enlightened being's power is so great that even the word Buddha can ward off death, in that it implants a seed for the attainment of liberation from the cycle of involuntary birth and death. So she's giving a summary of really of these first three verses that hopefully we'll get to today. But this idea of calling samsara the cycle of involuntary birth and death. Okay, we usually call it cyclic existence. Involuntary is quite good. You're under involuntary because you're born into a cyclic existence through not a choice of your own, but you're sort of helpless because you're under the power of something else, which you're under the power of your former actions, your former contaminated actions, and your afflictions. And the we say contaminated actions because they're the actions that you have done by your, motivated by your afflictions. So there's uncontaminated action. But that's when you are able to get beyond creating karma, which really doesn't happen until you're on the what we call the first level of the 10 levels of the Bodhisattva. So it's a very advanced spiritual maturation. So, up till then, everything is involuntary birth and death. Then the Buddha's Shakyamuni's silence in the face of certain questions shows his consummate skill resulting from omniscience, rather than demonstrating his lack of omniscience. A Buddha is thus the embodiment of perfected compassion, power, and wisdom. The outline doesn't actually make this point. I was looking to see. She sort of pulled this out. I thought it was a good way to look at the... usually they talk about Buddha's kensei nuba, that there's three things that you say about being a Buddha. One, ken means wisdom, like she's saying, and perfect knowledge, however you want to think of it. And then Tse is compassion, like she says, and then power is Nu. But power, I usually wonder, you know, well, in what way is a Buddha powerful? And she's what do you say, referring to this, the fact that even the word Buddha can ward off death, right? Because it implants the seed of liberation from our cyclic existence. So that's power, right? But it's altruistic power. I usually like to add the word altruistic power. Then the quality of one's, if we keep continue to read, the quality of one's mind and motivation is crucial in determining the value of actions. Bodhisattvas control their minds so effectively that they never do anything harmful. Through the power of their conventional altruistic intention to attain enlightenment for the good of all others, actions which would normally be harmful are transmuted and become constructive and beneficial. So she's using this long translation for bodhicitta, which is this altruistic intention to attain enlightenment for the good of all others. And we use the word the spirit of enlightenment, and you can say the conventional spirit of enlightenment if you want, but it's what makes you a bodhisattva. You're not a bodhisattva until you have this spontaneous motivation of the spirit of enlightenment. And that means it's uncontrived, that you don't have to think it up. It just comes spontaneously in everything that you do, that you're always, well, if you think, well, what is the spirit of enlightenment, then it's always good to bring to mind that definition. Semkye bani shenden chir yandago zope janchu de. The spirit of enlightenment is, or generating the spirit of enlightenment, you could say, is to desire perfect enlightenment for the sake of others. Okay, that is a definition by Maitreya, the future Buddha, and it's just handy to keep that in mind, because it shows that the spirit of enlightenment has both the fulfillment of your own aim in it, and the fulfillment of others. It means that fulfilling your own aim means that you're going to become a Buddha, you're going to become perfect, fully enlightened being, and then for the sake of others, in order to help others to become enlightened as well. So it fills the two aims of self and other. Actually, there's no becoming a Buddha without having the spirit of enlightenment. It's the key to becoming a Buddha. It's the main cause of being a Buddha. Therefore, the person who has it spontaneously, the bodhisattva, is on the way to becoming a Buddha. So, if we go back to the second paragraph, the last sentence. The merit of bodhisattvas who have developed the ultimate altruistic intention and attained the first bodhisattva ground is then discussed. So that's what I was referring to earlier. The ultimate altruistic intention is talking about a cognition, the direct cognition of emptiness. And that's what happens when you attain the bodhisattva ground, the first bodhisattva level. We were talking about the 10 levels, but they also referred to as the 10 grounds. So here, here it's going to be discussed later on. I don't think it's in this. Well, I guess it is in this chapter then. Let's see. Then the fifth chapter thus first describes enlightenment mainly in terms of enlightened activity. Then, to encourage us, that means the enlightened activity of a Buddha. Then to encourage us to attain that state and to develop a profound appreciation of bodhisattvas, it describes the transformative effects of the altruistic intention. The altruistic intention being the spirit of enlightenment. She's using that word, just the short word. Instead of saying spirit of enlightenment, she says altruistic intention. Implementing this intention through actions which benefit others requires imagination and sensitivity toward their needs and capacities. So here she's going to talk about the ability of the bodhisattvas to understand others and to be able to teach them and lead them towards freedom from cyclic existence. So, bodhisattvas use others' natural affinities and interests as a means of gradually leading them toward an understanding of reality. Oh, is that, that's Cindy, I think you have to put yourself on mute or something.
Cindy, I think.
Yeah, somebody's got a large amount of feedback there. Yeah. Make sure everybody that you're on mute. There, that's good. You got it. So then, we're on page 35, Cindy. I think you just came in, page 35 in the introduction. And we're on in the fourth paragraph where it says, right in the middle of the paragraph where it says, the more obstinate and confused they are, the greater the bodhisattva's compassion. Bodhisattvas do not hesitate to assume whatever role or relationship allows them to help most effectively, since this is their only concern. There is nobody with whom experienced bodhisattvas cannot communicate constructively. This is really just talking about skill and means, the ability of the bodhisattva to lead others towards an understanding of reality is what she's saying, but that means to bodhisattva, that when you have this spirit of enlightenment, then you're committed to freeing all living beings from their suffering. So it's that kind of a feeling that you have when you have this spirit of enlightenment, the conventional spirit of enlightenment. We don't usually have to refer to it, but she had the two there together. When you're talking about conventional and ultimate, then maybe you have to say conventional, but otherwise, when we say spirit of enlightenment, everybody understands just that altruistic intention to become enlightened for the sake of others. So, there is nobody with whom bodhisattvas cannot communicate constructively. This places a great responsibility on them, which they should never neglect. How can we fail to admire and appreciate them when we realize their true qualities? Not to do so and to feel hostility toward them is a grave error. So we're really going to learn about the Bodhisattva. And this whole paragraph reminded me of one question that when Jim was here, Jim Brennan, he was asking a question to Geshe-la about that the Bodhisattva's knowledge makes them so different, right, from others in terms of their experience. Their experience is that they're seeing the nature of reality, and they're also having great compassion for all beings and this great altruistic intention to become enlightened. So they have a very different perspective. So then Jim was basically saying, well, don't they feel a little, you know, out of place? Or, you know, wouldn't you feel a little, you know, like, I think basically it's sort of like out of place, right? Because it's so different from the way everybody else is seeing the world. Geshe-la said, no, not really, because you become more and more sensitive to how to help others. You're becoming more and more sensitized to what others need in order to get out of their suffering. So I thought that was such a beautiful explanation of it. But that's what this is talking about in chapter 5, just, you know, how the Bodhisattva is skilled in the means of helping others. So then the final paragraph here. A Bodhisattva's training consists of practicing the 6 perfections and the 4 ways of gaining others' trust in order to help them. Now, if I can remember, probably, do you know the 6 perfections? Everybody, is the perfection of generosity, ethical discipline, patience, joyous perseverance, meditative stabilization, and then wisdom. Those are the 6 perfections. The 4 ways of, the 4 ways of gaining others' trust in order to help them. Dubing Lobo Shi. A literal translation is more like the 4 ways of gathering disciples is what it's talking about. And that's talking about, now if I can remember what the 4 are. One is Sansangajimba, means to give material needs, you know, to provide material needs. Which one am I forgetting? And then one is to explain the teachings and then to act in accordance with the teachings that you get, to basically do what you say, practice what you preach. And then I'm forgetting the fourth one for some reason. Do you remember
it? I'm trying to remember.
I only got 2 out of your...
No, explain, first providing material needs, get whatever
right.
The person needs.
Right.
Explaining, giving the teachings.
Yeah.
Act in accordance with the teachings.
Yeah.
I always thought it was non-discrimination, or something like that, Josh. You know, not discriminating.
No. They're right here. Oh yeah, pleasant speech is teaching the perfection. It means here, if we look on page 225 of the second volume, generosity is as early explained in the sections of this perfection. So generosity means just giving material needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then pleasant speech is teaching the perfections to disciples. And the way we translated the next one is working at the aims, is setting disciples to work on the aims that they have been taught, or involving them in correctly taking up these aims. It means you're instructing them how to practice the teachings, you know, to achieve certain goals. And then consistency of behavior would be the fourth one. Is stabilizing yourself in the very aims in which you have established others, and then training in them. So you're basically practicing what you preach is what the, I always think of that one. So that you can think of the first one as generosity, I suppose, but usually it means, it is explained as giving material needs. I used to always think about it in terms of Bakshi, how he was a great cook. So he'd sew for us and you know, sew clothes for us and so forth. So it was just always like, you know, he used to say, everybody's coming here just to eat my food. But we were always very satisfied by his food. Nowadays, I think Losung Jamspel has sort of taken on that role of the one who gives food to all his students. So a bodhisattva's training consists of practicing the six perfections and the four ways of gaining others' trust in order to help them. Practice of the perfections creates the two great stores of merit and insight, which give rise to the wisdom and form bodies of a Buddha. So then, this is what a bodhisattva spends three immeasurable aeons doing, is accumulating merit and wisdom, we call it. She's calling it merit and insight. Because through merit, then, you get the form body of the Buddha, the physical appearance of the Buddha, and then through wisdom you get the what we call the truth body. She's calling it the wisdom body. It means the enlightened consciousness or the wisdom consciousness, or the knowledge of emptiness, knowledge of reality that a Buddha has. So then, Aryadeva then discusses the merit created by giving, the first of the perfections. We should not be daunted by the magnitude of the Mahayana perspective, nor by the profundity of its teaching, but should understand that perfect enlightenment is possible, since exceptional causes yield exceptional results. I was reading generosity is the first of the six perfections, but it's also sort of held up as the one that can be including all the others. It's sort of like an exceptional, the exceptional practice of the bodhisattva is generosity. And I think I'll get a little bit more to that when we read the next part. Anybody have any questions before we switch over to page 149, which is where we get a perspective on this chapter from Geshe Sunam Rinchen, who is the one that Ruth Sunam worked with to translate this. If you have any questions, anybody miss anything along the way? Okay, so then we'll just go right to this first sentence on chapter one, at the end of chapter 5 on page 149. The inconceivable activities of bodhisattvas who are motivated by love, compassion, and the altruistic intention in all that they do are distinguished by six excellent features. So here, this is a loaded sentence, actually. This whole thing, unpacking what Geshe Sunam Rinchen has written here is quite a challenge. But the inconceivable activities of bodhisattvas. I thought, right from the beginning, well, why is it that bodhisattvas' activities are inconceivable? And, well, if we... there's some stories that illustrate the inconceivability of a bodhisattva's deeds. And two of the most famous ones have to do with, again, generosity and but giving your body, okay, that a bodhisattva has this ability to give away his or her body and to somebody who might need it. And bodhisattvas can be in any form that they choose, often simultaneously in many different forms, depending on where, how far they've advanced in terms of whether they're on the first level, the second level, third level, that sort of exponentially, they can start out with like 100 different bodies at once, and then it goes exponentially, 10 times that, 10,000, the next one, and so forth, until they can have like 100,000 bodies at once. So then, and it's whatever is appropriate to be helping others. So one story is where you have the bodhisattva as a king, and this is, I often tell this one, so maybe I'll have a different one that I'll tell this time. And this is the one where that he sees the tigress is about to, a tigress is about to, he's a prince, he's not really a king at that time. He's out wandering in the jungle and he sees a tigress who's about, it's a time of great famine in there, in his kingdom, and he sees this tigress is going to eat her four cubs. And so then he manages to get his retinue to, go away, go to get him something, or they said, "Oh, bring him something to eat." And so they all run away, and then he throws himself. They have these wonderful pictures of the bodhisattva leaping off of this
precipice.
Really, he's high above the tigress, and then he lands in a heap amongst these tigers, and then his body is consumed by these tigers, and he spares the lives of these tigers, and he does it all very happily. This is the ability of the bodhisattvas to give away their bodies and to do it with great pleasure is often discussed. How can they do that? It's because of their understanding of emptiness and their understanding of the reality of how things are. And I think that's really why it's so inconceivable to us, because we have no idea of what it would be like to have this kind of, as she refers to it, as a non-conceptual knowledge of emptiness, this direct experience of emptiness. And the story that I wanted to tell, though, is this other one where it's because you often hear this, the idea of the rabbit, and it may be better to say hare, H-A-R-E. That this time the bodhisattva, usually when we say the bodhisattva, we're talking about a former lifetime of the person who became the Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni. So then, he's referred to as the bodhisattva. And these stories are actually written in by Arya Aryashura, sorry. There's a book here called The Marvelous Companion, Life Stories of the Buddha. And it's published by Dharma Publishing. And one of our colleagues, Debbie Black, edited this. And it's a marvelous edition of these stories of the Buddha's former lives as a bodhisattva. Ashvaghosha, it says Aryashura here. Sometimes it's called Ashvaghosha, too. Or Matricheta, he has all these different names, but basically he was a very strong non-Buddhist who was defeating a lot of Buddhists in debate, and Aryadeva, the author of our book, defeated him, and then part of the deal was then he had to convert to Buddhism, and so then that's kind of a well, he wasn't a very good converter either, and so then he had a very strong experience which involved one of the higher level bodhisattvas appearing to him and sort of like beating him over the head, I think, as I remember.
Didn't he lock him in a room too?
Yeah, and he was locked in a room and so forth, And finally, he made you know this commitment to writing books about the Buddha, and so this is one of the books that he wrote, and he was a great author, a Buddhist author. He wrote many books, but this one is probably one of the more well known, and so then the story of the hare is one that has to do with the bodhisattva being reborn as an animal, and he was a hare, and he lived amongst the animals and was greatly admired by the animals. These stories depict animals as being able to, or bodhisattvas being able to teach amongst the animals. And so he had three main disciples. One was an otter, the other one was a jackal, and the other one was a monkey. And so he would teach them, and they gained great insight through learning with the bodhisattva hare. It's about the moon is coming full now, I'm noticing as I go out in the night, and so then actually it will be full when Geshe Eshe Tapke comes on Thursday, when he comes back here. So then this is also appropriate to tell this story because of that, but the hare pointed out that the full moon was coming up. He was telling us, and it's a very blessed time where you do some special religious practice, and that's the Buddhist tradition. But he was explaining to his disciples that if we have a visitor, then we have to be especially good to that visitor and give them, you know, special things and make them feel comfortable. And that was his idea of what should be done on that day. I'm not familiar with this particular custom, but it must be that custom in India. And so the idea is really this is Indian culture that the hare is involved in. And so he... his disciples then go off, and he thinks to himself, "Oh, I'm just a poor little rabbit, you know. What do I have to give anybody? And you know, all I do is eat grass. And what am I going to do? Give somebody some grass, you know?" That's also illustrates one thing. If you're going to be reborn as an animal, you're better off being reborn just eating grass, being a grass eater, because then you're not accumulating a lot of bad karma, you know, killing a lot of insects or like a bird would, or killing other animals like a tiger would. So you're better off in the role of a grass eater. But the Bodhisattva, anyway, in this role was, as a hare, was bemoaning his situation. He said, what can I do? What can I? Well, I could just give my body. He decided that he could give his body. And so then, in these stories, then the gods are listening in and watching the Bodhisattva, what he's doing. And so then this one god, Chakra, is the one who sort of gets involved in these stories and interferes and tests the Bodhisattva. So he said, when everybody heard, all the gods heard this, they said, oh, isn't that marvelous what the Bodhisattva is doing? What an amazing being. But Chakra is sort of like, well, let's see if he's, you know, can put his, you know, money where his mouth is, as we say in our culture. And then he goes and comes down as a visitor, you know, as a visitor on the full moon day. He's a Brahmin. I've seen him depicted in other ways, but it's one of the favorite stories, really, this one story. But anyway, he was a Brahmin, a religious person, and so then he was sort of lost in the jungle there, in the forest, and he couldn't find his way, and he's crying out for help and asking, can't somebody bring me some food? Can't somebody, you know, he's just like in a really difficult situation, yelling and screaming. And so these animals then, oh, here's a wayward stranger that we can help on this day, you know, on the full moon day. So they say, oh, we will help you, sir. And all four of them come, you know, the Bodhisattva and his three disciples. Jackal? I meant jackal. One of them's a jackal, one of them's an otter, and one of them's a monkey. So then the otter brings some fish. He finds like seven fish. He said, oh, I found these seven fish for you. You please have them. Somebody left them on the bank of the river, or they jumped out. I'm not sure why they're here. But here, please have them. And so he was able to provide some fish. And the monkey had all sorts of fruits that he had gathered from the trees, and he offered them to the jackal. The jackal had, I can't remember exactly what, the jackal had some, like, he had found some, like, a pot of yogurt or something that somebody had left, and he brought that, and then there was some other thing that he had. I can't remember exactly what it was. And so he was able to provide, but of course the poor rabbit couldn't do anything, right? But Chakra knew his intention, right? That he had made this vow to offer his body, right? So then Chakra, of course, made a fire, you know, make the whole thing easier. And so then the rabbit leapt into the fire and offered his body to the stranger. And then Chakra was so moved by this that he took the rabbit's body to show it to all the other deities in the heavens, and proclaim the wonderful deeds of the Bodhisattva, what he is capable of doing. And then I thought, this is a nice touch. And then he gave the impression on the moon of a rabbit. So then, if you know Tibetan, one of the synonyms for the moon is rabbit holder, because when you look at the full moon, you can see an image of a rabbit there. We say the man on the moon, but in Indian lore, it's a rabbit. So then, so this bodhisattva made this great sacrifice, right? And the idea is that there's an inconceivability because of the largeness of the sacrifice, being able to give your own body or parts of your body.
Happily
too. Sure. You know, it's not painfully. You know. And so that's what it means here by inconceivable deeds of the bodhisattva. Then so here Geshe Sunam Rinchen is said they're distinguished by six excellent features. If we bear these in mind and try to integrate them as far as possible, the quality of our own everyday actions will be transformed. So he's really stressing the use of these six excellent features. And in the second paragraph, he says that these features actually alter our perspective, alter our normal perspective. So these are very crucial. That when I read them, I said, "Well, these sound familiar." So then I looked in volume 2 there. And they're actually. The way we translated them in Volume 2 was Volume 2 of the Great Treatise. On page 121, they're from, Asanga's Mahayana Compendium. So whenever Jade Tsongkhapa explains the six perfections in Volume 2. Each perfection, he says, there's a section on how you should practice, and you should practice it with these six excellent features, or six supremacies is what we call them. And so I thought that when we read these, we can get two different perspectives on these six excellent features by reading them from two different books. So the first one here, bodhisattvas' actions have an excellent basis, and that they are motivated by the wish to attain enlightenment in order to help others with total efficacy. Now, so it's talking about that their basis is this spirit of enlightenment. And this reference to helping others with total efficacy is referring to that when you become, basically, why does a bodhisattva want to become a Buddha? Because then you're totally effective at helping others. When you know exactly what others need, and you spontaneously provide them with what they need in order to be liberated from their suffering. So it's motivated by a wish to attain enlightenment in order to help others with the total efficacy that an enlightened being would have. Now, in the Great Treatise, this is referred to as the supreme basis. Supreme basis means that you practice generosity, for instance. This is in the context of at the end of the chapter on, or the chapters on perfection of generosity. So it says, explains them in reference to that particular perfection. supreme basis means that you practice generosity based on the spirit of enlightenment, i.e. that you act after you have been motivated by it. So Jay Tsongkhapa is asking that you act, you're acting out of this motivation. Then the next one here, they are performed with an excellent objective of impartially helping all sentient beings to find temporary and ultimate happiness. Now, here in the Great Treatise, this is called Supreme Aim. Supreme aim is when you give things away to all living beings for the sake of their immediate happiness and ultimate benefit. So this is always what when Geshe Geshe Thapgya is explaining why would you practice any of these things? It's because that in the short term you'll be happy, and in the long term you receive great benefit. So this is the idea here expressed by immediate happiness, right? In this lifetime, you'll be happy by being generous. And in the long term, in your future lives, then the effect of being generous is that you will receive a lot of resources in your future lives. So it has an ultimate or long-term benefit as well. So that's the idea from excellent objective or supreme aim. Then the next excellent feature is whatever bodhisattvas do is intended as an excellent purification of the obstructions to liberation and omniscience by counteracting them. So the obstructions to liberation and omniscience also are referred to as the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. This translation of calling them obstructions is done from the viewpoint of their meaning, because they obstruct you from, the afflictive obscurations obstruct you from obtaining liberation, and the cognitive obscurations obstruct you from becoming a Buddha, or from becoming enlightened. But the word really means obscuration. It's drip. It doesn't mean obstruction. So then, in what way are they obscurations? Means they obscure the clear light nature of your mind. Okay, the nature of the mind is pure or clear light. And so these obscurations obscure that clear light nature of the mind. And so what are the afflictive obscurations? It's the afflictions, like ignorance, hostility, attachment, hatred, different kinds of wrong views, and so forth. It's the afflictions. And then the cognitive obscurations or obstructions to omniscience are the latencies or predisposing latencies that these afflictions leave in the mind, sort of like some kind of an imprint. And that's what the bodhisattva is working to get rid of. It's said that only through the bodhisattva's practice can you get rid of these cognitive obscurations. And that doesn't happen till later on in their development through these 10 levels, the 10 levels of the bodhisattva. But they actually start to get rid of them, and you become, they're, like it says, you become omniscient. You know, they're the obstructions to being omniscient. And they're obscuring the clear night light nature of the mind. We all have this ability to become Buddhas, right? And so this potential of becoming a Buddha is obscured. And then purification means you're getting rid of all these things that are obscuring that, you know, that potential. Like His Holiness the Dalai Lama says that, you know, most of Buddhist practice is really removing things. You can look at it as a fact of purifying yourself, removing the obscurations. So then, so now we're on the excellent means. Accompanying whatever they do is the understanding of emptiness. So that means having the understanding of emptiness in whatever they do. Here, that's called supreme skill in means in volume 2. Supreme skill and means is said to be when generosity is imbued with non-conceptual sublime wisdom. That's the sublime wisdom that a bodhisattva has when they reach that first ground. Then beginning bodhisattvas, there are bodhisattvas before that who are on the of the five paths, right? There's the path of accumulation, the path of preparation. Then there's the path of seeing, that's where the first ground or the first level begins. That is the first level. That's when you see emptiness directly experienced, and you have this non-conceptual sublime wisdom. But beginning bodhisattvas then have the kind of wisdom that they're using is expressed here. Beginning bodhisattvas should take this to be the wisdom that knows the lack of intrinsic nature in objects. So that's a slightly different explanation of this one, so that it's bodhisattvas, advanced and beginning bodhisattvas. And then the next one here, where are we now? The excellent means here.
Chibadamba.
Yeah, in each activity they employ, the excellent conduct of incorporating the practice of all the perfections. So here it's called excellent conduct. Incorporating the practice of all the perfections means that you incorporate the practice of all the perfections in each perfection you practice. So you can, and that's expressed here in from the same place that I in volume 2 on page 121. So, for instance, if you're practicing generosity, it says here, when you are giving the teachings, for instance, it is extremely powerful if you practice all six perfections. You have ethical discipline when you restrain yourself from the considerations of Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. That means when the Bodhisattvas, one of their main thing that they have to always be restraining themselves from is sort of they're tempted by the goal of achieving their own liberation from cyclic existence. So that when you say about the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas, then they're always tempted towards this, that their goal, which is their own liberation or their own salvation. It's because living beings are so hard to help that you get kind of discouraged. You got to watch out. And then you say, well, why don't I just opt out for my own liberation? And so then they're always having to, you know, what do you say, counteract their discouragement, and they're also their temptation of just achieving their own liberation. So then patience when you bear any hardship while you aspire to the qualities of omniscience, and when you are patient with abuse from others. Joyous perseverance when you yearn for the ever greater increase of your generosity. Meditative stabilization when you dedicate to complete enlightenment the virtue that you cultivate with one-pointed attention, unmixed with Hinayana considerations. So this is again talking about that same idea of being tempted to, for your own liberation, that you're cultivating one-pointed attention unmixed with Hinayana considerations. Hinayana is referring to the goal of the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas. There's three disciples of the Buddha, the Shravakas, the Pratyeka Buddhas, and then the Bodhisattvas. So the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas have this goal of their own liberation from cyclic existence, whereas the Bodhisattvas have this goal of wanting to liberate everyone. So then, so they practicing what's called the Mahayana, whereas the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas are practicing the Hinayana. So they're all going to end up in the same place. They're eventually everybody's going to be a Buddha, but it just for the Pratyeka Buddhas and the Shravakas, it takes longer. Because they opt out and get blissed out, and then they get sort of left behind, and then finally a Buddha comes along and says, you haven't reached the final goal. And they go, oh, really? No? And then they have to, like, go back and begin start at the beginning of the Bodhisattva's path. So they have to go through, you know, they have to sort of go back to square one, in a sense. It's advance, really, to square one. But in the meantime, they could have been, you know, advancing if they had, you know, just been patient, like it says here, with taking on all the difficulties of liberating other beings from their suffering. So this one is called excellent conduct. This doesn't have a parallel in the Sangha's Mahayana compendium. Instead of saying excellent conduct, there's this one entry that said supreme things, okay? It's a different idea. Supreme things means that in general you give all objects that can be given. And even when you are engaged in specific acts of generosity, you do not give up this thought of giving away everything. So you just, it's like total generosity that you want to give away everything. it's kind of attitude in a way. And so it's different from this idea of excellent conduct. And then, yeah, I don't know exactly where these were taken from. If this one is a Sangha, the author of the great treatise is taking them from a Sangha, and these must be, they're almost the same, except for that, those two. So, then conclude by making an excellent dedication for the happiness and unsurpassable enlightenment of all sentient beings. So, supreme dedication is also here in the Volume 2, it says, means that you dedicate the virtue from generosity to complete enlightenment. So then Geshe Sonam Rinchen is saying, oh, try bringing these into everything that you do during your day. And this is the way to make the bodhisattva deeds more immediate for you. And it's very transformative. Try to integrate them as far as possible. And then the quality of our own everyday actions will be transformed. So he's making them a very practical, objective for in our lives to have these. Then the next paragraph, the second paragraph. By cultivating unselfishness and the wish to benefit others as fully as possible, while recalling and trying to practice these excellent features which alter our normal perspective, we prepare to become bodhisattvas ourselves. So he's saying this is a good way to prepare ourselves to becoming bodhisattvas. But you have to be cultivating unselfishness and the wish to benefit others as fully as possible. I've always wondered. Well, I do wonder what the word for unselfishness is here, you don't have the advantage of having the Tibetan to look in this advice. So, unselfishness is not something that I usually use as a translation term, but I think it could be used. Basically, what selfishness means is making yourself more important than others, and that's what we have to work against, because it's something that comes naturally. It's an innate in just our misconception of self. When we have this misconception of the self as being some kind of an independent entity that. And that's the way we just naturally think of the self, of ourselves. Then sort of what comes right along with that is this idea that we're important and that we're more important than others. And so then the bodhisattva practice is actually working always against that. It's the idea that's inherent in self-cherishing. We call this word, we use this word self-cherishing, and some people say self, what is this? Being preoccupied with ourselves. Okay, just always, or self-centeredness. And people try many different ideas, but it's just, that you're putting yourself before others. And so, the Mahayana practice, or it's not just Mahayana, Buddhist practice is to, and practice of many other religions, in fact, is to always try to put others before yourself, and to, or at least along the same, equal with yourself. And so then you have this idea of practicing unselfishness. A bodhisattva is trying to reorient themselves from just always being preoccupied with themselves to being totally preoccupied with others, only thinking of others. Another way that's expressed is, instead of being self-centered, being other-centered. You're only thinking of others. So all their activities or deeds that they're practicing and training in for three immeasurable aeons is to change that whole habit of being preoccupied with themselves to being totally preoccupied with others. It's a total reorientation of their whole psyche, so that they're, and that's what's so marvelous about the Buddha, that the Buddha was, like ourselves, an ordinary person, and over countless aeons, he or she, and we can refer to him as he because he's the Buddha, but through many lifetimes, he or she was always working, right, to be totally preoccupied with others, and was able to do that, so and become fully enlightened for our benefit, right, the thinking of others, right. And so here we have this marvelous being, a perfect being, who's totally there for others all the time, spontaneously. So that's this idea of cultivating unselfishness and the wish to benefit others as fully as possible. And then if you bring into that these six excellent features, then you're preparing to become a bodhisattva yourself. Since the mind plays a pivotal role, the ultimate value of our activities depends on the attitude with which they are performed. Intelligent action based on good intention increases our store of positive energy and has a beneficial effect on others. So he's encouraging us to use our intelligence with good intention, and that we'll be able to create a lot of merit by doing this. This is this store of positive energy. We usually say accumulate merit, right? And it has a beneficial effect on others and will be helpful to others. So that's that idea in skill and means, that you're using your intelligence and you're trying to, this is what Ruth was talking about the bodhisattva, being able to really, there's no being that a bodhisattva can't communicate well with, you know, because they use their intelligence and their good intention to be helpful to others, right? So then the third paragraph here. Bodhisattvas can act unselfishly without difficulty. But when we attempt to emulate them, we should at first be prudent, taking into account our own capacities and circumstances. This is an interesting paragraph because a lot of people, when they hear about the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva's deeds, want to become a, you know, self-sacrificing right away, you know, and then let's get to it. So he's sort of saying, well, wait a sec. You know, you have to take into account your own capacities and circumstances. And one of the more famous quotes, I guess, is you don't give away your flesh, right? You can't give away your body, right? Till you feel it's like giving away a piece of vegetable. That's one of the, I think that's in, did you find that, Diana? Was that in? And I think that's part of the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life.
Yeah, right. I don't know which, I can't remember.
Maybe in generosity, was it?
Maybe.
Well, there's no particular chapter on generosity, right?
I don't remember which verse.
But anyway, it's in there somewhere. And that I remember actually. It might be actually in chapter 6. It's just you're able to give away your I remember the commentaries talking about it, because you have this understanding of emptiness, then you're able, you know, profound understanding of emptiness, and it's so different from our understanding of ourself as being some kind of an independent entity, right? When you understand that you're not that kind of a, you know, that, oh, when you're not that kind of a, you know, that's a misconception of self, and then you get this very different idea of self, right? And usually we would think of our body, right, as being me, right? This is, how could I give away me, right? But it's true that, you know, there is no person without a body or a mind, right? So that's what we, the person. But you know, the misconception of self has this attachment to the self, this very strong attachment to the self. And a bodhisattva gets rid of that strong attachment to the self. It's so they don't, they're just thinking of other, right? And there's that one, you know, that one verse where Dambo Ngase Dakla Sheng Gyur Ching, right? Right from the beginning. You think I, and then you're attached to the I. You know, you think I, and you're attached to the self, right? You get very attached. You get a strong sense of attachment. And Geshe Ishitabhi was saying in his first class this summer about that we really, because that attachment is so strong, then it's like we're making up that this misconceived self, okay? We have this misconceived self, you know, what do you say? A misconceived notion of the self, right? That we're, because we're so attached to it, we're just like forcing it to be there, you know? That it's always present in our life because we don't want to give it up, right? You don't want to give it up. So then, when the bodhisattva doesn't have that, then they can give away their bodies, right? Like the bodhisattva hair. So instead, what we should be based on is, let's see, oh, here in the second sentence, I guess, of that third paragraph. In this way, we avoid the possibility of regretting a positive action performed impulsively, for such regret is very detrimental. So you don't want to be regretful for having given away, you know, $10,000 to whatever organization. Once you do it, then you should be happy you did it. You know? And then you won't ruin the effect of it. But if you give it away and then you go, oh gee, I really don't have $10,000 to give away, and then you sort of ruin the merit that you're getting from that kind of a gift. So you have to be very careful that it's within your own capacity, you know, that you have the money to give, then you can give it. For instance, so instead, what we should be based on, no, what we do should be based on a realistic assessment of our capabilities. Meanwhile, we should inspire ourselves to become more courageous and unselfish by imagining that we are doing for others what we find too demanding at present. If practiced continually, this kind of mental training can have a profound transformative effect. This is a very interesting, maybe we have to, getting towards the end of the class, I don't know if there are any questions, but this idea of using our imagination to sort of imagine what we are doing for others, what we find too demanding at present. Like imagine ourselves giving away our bodies, or imagine He said that you can practice that way of imagining. I remember early on that people would always be quite, said, how can imagination in that way be helpful, right? It's because of the idea of aspiration. You can aspire to be like that. I mean, if you can't imagine yourself, I mean, we study the deeds of the bodhisattvas and what it would be like to be a bodhisattva. And obviously, when you're studying, you're going to imagine yourself in that role as being somebody who can actually do these things, right? Like jump into a fire, you know, if you didn't have so much attachment, right? And so that kind of imagination, and also when we say prayers, we do a lot of visualization and imagine ourselves as being a Buddha that's sending out transformative rays of light that help others to become Buddhas, and you're always using your imagination, and it's kind of an aspiration. You can say, I could be like that, you know. But what he's saying is that you also have to understand that, you know, even though you can imagine yourself in that role, you're not there, you know. So you have to have a realistic assessment of where you are, you know. And so then maybe we can finish these next two paragraphs here. But he's saying it's a kind of mental training. If you're doing that, you're training yourself. Like we go through, you know, a very exacting study of what are the steps to becoming a bodhisattva, and you're sort of imagining yourself going through those steps. What would it be like to, you know, have a non-conceptual understanding of emptiness, which is like the mind, where the mind and emptiness are like fresh water being poured into fresh water. It's sort of like unimaginable, that one, you know. What would that be like, you know? You try to imagine yourself, and it sounds like something, you know, worth aspiring to, right? So then through aspiring, then you make effort to go there. You have to have aspiration, you know, in order to begin something. You have to aspire to, and you have to have some kind of a picture of what the goal would be like, right? So when helping others, their inclination and aptitudes must be taken into consideration. Since we can only hope to benefit them if what we do or say is attuned to their needs and personalities. Thus, intelligence and empathy are essential to establish what is relevant. So we have to be able to take into consideration others' inclinations and aptitudes in order to be of benefit to them. And so then you have to be using your intelligence and empathy, sort of putting yourself in their shoes, to then understand what is relevant to be able to help them. So this is talking about what Ruth was saying about the bodhisattvas being able to have great skill and means, right? And that's what this chapter will be going into. Since bodhisattvas are willing to take any form, right, the rabbit or the king or the prince or whatever, no matter how humble, to help others, we should also be prepared to adopt an inferior position when necessary. Willingness, a cheerful expression, and gentle speech lend grace to our actions and make others feel valued.
It's 3:00.
Now he's giving basically, these are called precepts. Usually it's just sort of like instructional advice. It's really advice. We should avoid actions that we find disturbing and upsetting when done by others, and behave in ways that that from our own experience we know give joy and happiness. By doing what we can at present and making heartfelt prayers to be capable of more ambitious actions for others' sake in the future, we grow stronger and more courageous. More courageous, really. Whenever I see that word, courageous, the bodhisattvas have great courage. That's what, and it comes from their compassion. They have such a deep, you know, feeling for others to help them out of their suffering. This great compassion that they have, and it's impartial. And so then, like on the stupa, the symbol of the lions on the stupa, that symbolizes compassion, because when you have great compassion, then you're like a lion. There's nothing, you're the king of the jungle. You have nothing to fear. It's like the most courageous. Your courage comes from compassion. Self-confidence comes from compassion. And so then, whenever I see that word courage, I think of compassion, sort of as synonymous. So anyway, I thought those were two good ways to introduce us to this next chapter, chapter 5. And if anybody had any questions about what we were talking about, we didn't get to the verses, but we can get to the verses next time. Anybody have any questions? Or if not, that's okay. We can have questions the next time. You can think about it.
Josh, it's Nancy. Could I ask a question?
Yeah.
Just a short one, maybe.
Yeah.
Nowadays, lately in the news, there have been these sad situations of Tibetan monks and nuns lighting, you know, burning their bodies.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes when I hear the stories you told about today about bodhisattvas giving away their bodies, and then I see something like that happen, I wonder how. I haven't taken the time to read His Holiness's commentary on it, but I wonder how those two are or are not related. Like, would those people be coming from a place where they were thinking they were following the teachings that we're hearing about today, or is this something else, or is this like a misunderstanding?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, Nancy. It's something that has been discussed a lot in some Buddhist forums that I was reading. Gray sent me some stuff. Is it unprecedented? For instance, to do this, is there any precedent for it? And apparently, in Tibetan culture, there is precedent for it. Somebody, for instance, usually it's out of devotion. The precedent, the one that, like in front of the Joe, you know, in the central cathedral in Lhasa, somebody in, I think in the 17th century, burned their body as an offering to the Buddha, for instance, and I think that others. There are other instances. I forget that there was one more instance, but the Chinese are saying this is unprecedented. But it's not unprecedented in Tibetan culture or in Mahayana Buddhism. When we were young and during the Vietnam period, there was one monk who burned his body. And I think that's really the precedent for this particular way of what the young Tibetan monks are doing, because it was a similar situation where the Catholic administration of Vietnam, South Vietnam those days, was oppressing the Buddhists, and this man burned his body out of a, you know, to bring attention to that, and I think in an effective way. Bakshi was actually questioned a lot about that when it happened, because that's back in the early 60s. That was 63, I guess. And so then Bakshi used to tell us that you can burn your body like that when you can sit there and meditation and not flinch, okay, when your body is burnt. And that's what this man did, this South Vietnamese man. When he burned his body, he didn't move an inch. It's incredible, very impressive display. I'm not sure what's happening with these young Tibetan monks and nuns, because you don't get any information, right? So some of them could be like that, right? It's entirely possible. Or they could, you know, be causing themselves a lot of, you know, difficulty, because imagine trying to burn yourself and being very uncomfortable and running around and trying to put it out. That's also the other extreme. But I think it's pretty universally acknowledged that they're trying to bring attention to the you know, intensity of their unhappiness under the oppression of Chinese rule. So, and in that particular area, it happens to be one of the more oppressive of the oppressive, you know, area of Tibet. Ngaba, it's called. Apparently, Gray tried to go there years ago. Nobody could get in there because they always kept it closed to foreigners, because that particular tribal area, they were always so resistant to Chinese rule. And then the Chinese are making it even more oppressive. So I think it's an act of desperation that they're... And His Holiness the Dalai Lama feels that to do any harm to yourself is violence, and he advocates nonviolence. So it's very much against what he's always advocated. I think there was one person, a lay person, who did burn themselves once, and I think maybe 10, 15 years ago, in a demonstration in Delhi, in India. But out of a political motivation, and His Holiness was so worried about this man, and he was hospitalized and so forth, and it was terrible for His Holiness. So I'm sure that it's something that His Holiness is very disturbed about, but it's not anything that he has control over, because nobody can get into that area. So it's a very unfortunate situation. It seems like a very desperate situation to me, and to most everybody who hears and thinks about it. But if you like, I can send those references to you. And there is one article that talks about suicide. You know, it's really suicide. His Holiness is very much against suicide. And so then it's a long article about suicide in Buddhism and how it fits into Buddhism. I didn't read the article, so I couldn't summarize it for you, but I can send it to you. Well, that's a good question. Anybody else have any questions? So if not, maybe we can dedicate. Anybody else who's interested in that article, you can just send me an email. I'll send it to you. I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the hero Manjushri, and likewise Samantabhadra as well, with whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors who traverse the three times. I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious deeds.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you
all.
Thank you, Joshua. Great class.
Oh. Very good class.
Good. Hope it helps you. Hope it helps you recover there, Rick.
I'm sure it will. Yes, thank you very much.
Nothing like hearing about bodhisattvas. But
this hospital is wonderful, wonderful care. And when I said that I was missing this, my Danish nurse got busy and got this all together for me. So
isn't that wonderful?
Wow.
That is impressive.
Budding bodhisattva.
Take care.
Yeah, that's great.
Gift of the Dharma.
Well, take care. I hope everything goes well. Let us know, you know. So,
yeah.
What they tell you. You sound okay.
Yeah, I'm much better today.
Oh, good.
And we'll get the culture results tomorrow.
Oh.
And see what's happening.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you all have electricity.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, believe me, we are. Came on at 12:20 yesterday. We were like in shock. We sort of staggered around with the idea that we could have electricity again. You know, we were ready to wait till next Wednesday. Yeah, it was hard. I guess because you grow up with it, then you get really accustomed to it. And don't know any other way, right? But you know, we were lucky we had the generator. It seemed to supply our needs.
But then I grew up.
Temporarily, anyway.
So, I did try to do a transcription. It will take me a while to get it to you in usable form, but I will.
Okay, thanks.
But also, you know,
okay, well, good to see you all and hear you all.
You too.
Yeah, have a good day. I guess out in California, you've still got a big chunk of your day left there, Fred.
Sure do. It's only about 12 o'clock here.
Yeah, right. So anyway, have a good day. And, Nancy is just beginning her day.
It's a little later now, though, because we didn't change our clocks.
Oh, okay.
So now it's a 5-hour time difference instead of 6.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for reminding me. Okay, well, good to see you all. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Where's Fred? Fred's in
Yeah, there's some kind of a
meditation.
What does he say? A meditation thing?
Shinai
Dharma. Yeah, right. Well, that was nice to think and talk about the bodhisattva, right?